Good morning. Now, Winston Churchill is a personal hero of mine to whom I often turn for inspiration. He was a man who never shied from a fight, who knew the price of victory, who stood on principle, shaking a clenched fist toward the sky, willing the Luftwaffe to defeat. And let's face it, he was eminently quotable and could distill complex ideas into simple truths. It was Churchill who once said, "Kites rise highest against the wind, not with it." We know that. The U.S. ethanol industry is fighting against some very strong winds today. But because of it, we will soar. After beginning with great promise, including the approval of E15 by the EPA and projections of a bumper crop, 2012 became one of the most challenging years in the history of the American ethanol industry. Mother Nature wreaked havoc on our feedstock. Falling gasoline demand, rising imports, and a host of regulatory and commercial barriers to E15 wreaked havoc on our marketplace. And the angry birds at the Chicken Council and the mad cows at the American Meat Institute and the big spending oil companies have blended a witch's brew of half-truths, untruths, and distortions to wreak havoc with the public understanding and political support for the continued growth and evolution of our vital industry. So as we gather here this morning, the state of the ethanol industry can be summed up in five words: under siege, but fighting back. We are challenged at the plant to produce profitably. We are challenged in the marketplace to find new demand. And we are challenged at home and in Washington to reclaim our rightful moniker as an American-made, clean-burning, cost-effective, environmentally friendly, renewable fuel that can help rebuild our country's economic, environmental, and energy future. American ethanol is engaged in a battle for the barrel. This is about market share. The stakes are high. Our adversaries are well-funded, and our challenges are legion. During the darkest days of the Battle of Britain, Winston Churchill told his countrymen and women, "We did not come this far because we are made of sugar candy." Well, I know this industry. I know the people in this room. I know the hard-working men and women at your plants, the sales force who markets your fuel, the farmers who grow your feedstock, the thousands upon thousands who depend upon this industry for their livelihood every day. You aren't sugar candy either. We faced the worst, and we're still here. We will not go away. We will not give up. We will rebound and continue to build this industry into the juggernaut of innovation, efficiency, and promise that we know it to be. Yes. These are tough times, but they're not as tough as we are. Because of the drought and the downturn, 36 of the 211 plants across the country have temporarily shut their doors. Many more have cut back production. Our industry is operating at approximately 85% of capacity. And for the first time in 17 years, production declined from the previous year. In fact, our output fell by more than 600 million gallons to about what we produced in 2010. But our greatest challenge isn't our industry's production. It's artificially constrained demand fueled by oil company propaganda. The American Petroleum Institute has declared war on the RFS. The AAA is campaigning against E15. The public has been so inundated with misinformation that they now see a Pavlovian connection between ethanol and food prices. And even some of our most ardent congressional champions are growing weary of the fight. But the real story of 2012 isn't that we were taking hits. The real story isn't that sometimes we got knocked down. The real story is that we kept bouncing back. Look at what we were able to accomplish in the face of the worst drought in 50 years and the worst market in memory. In 2012, we produced 13.3 billion gallons of high-quality, high-octane fuel ethanol, representing 9.7% of the nation's motor fuel marketed in every state from coast to coast and border to border. We saw the first E15 station open up, a Phillips 66 station in Lawrence, Kansas. Thank you, Scott Zaremba. We produced 36.6 million metric tons of livestock feed, enough feed to produce the cattle to serve every American 4 quarter-pounders a week for the entire year. On a corn equivalent basis, we produced enough feed to be the fourth largest corn producer on the planet, behind only the U.S., China, and Brazil. Where's the food versus fuel dilemma in that? Even in the midst of the drought and the downturn during 2012, the U.S. ethanol industry supported 87,000 direct jobs and 295,000 indirect and induced jobs. We added $43 billion to the GDP and provided $30 billion in household income to families all across the country. Depending on the study you choose, we saved consumers between 78 cents and $1.09 a gallon, or about $1,200 per family. That's something AAA should actually care about. The naysayers keep saying that the cellulose industry is never going to happen. But the real news is that in 2012, the first commercial cellulose plant was completed, and several others began construction. INEOS in Florida is producing cellulosic ethanol today. And from Abengoa in Kansas to Ziachem in Oregon, the future of the ethanol industry can now be seen. That innovative spirit is not confined to second-generation facilities, though. The first generation has its share of imagination, too. Despite the downturn in the market, indeed, perhaps because of it, corn ethanol plants are adopting new technologies and improving efficiencies. Look at how quickly the industry embraced corn oil extraction, and how others are looking at new processes that will create high-value chemical streams or extract proteins, provide combined heat and power, improve anaerobic digesters, and enhance fermentation. That's the story of 2012. Using the latest version of GREET developed by the Department of Energy, the 13.3 billion gallons of ethanol produced in 2012 reduced greenhouse gas emissions from on-road vehicles by 33.4 million tons. That's equivalent to removing 5.2 million vehicles from the road. Indeed, as science catches up with policy, we're finding that ethanol's carbon footprint is improving and is far smaller than our detractors have suggested. The most recent data concludes that corn ethanol reduces greenhouse gas emissions by 48 to 59% when compared directly to gasoline, and by 34% even when highly uncertain speculative land use emissions are added. If compared to the marginal gallon of gasoline that would be needed to replace ethanol, whether from Canadian oil sands or unconventional tight oils derived from fracking here, the carbon benefit of ethanol is exponentially greater. Environmentalists need to wake up and smell the environmentally responsible coffee. The only way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the near term is with more ethanol, not less. So in spite of this terrible year, the story of the industry is the same as ever. We are supporting tens of thousands of high-wage jobs. We are saving consumers money at the pump. We are stimulating investment in rural economies. We are reinvesting in new technologies to improve efficiencies. We are reducing our nation's dependence on imported oil. And we are improving the environment. That's a record we can stand on and be proud of and shout from the rooftops, even as we struggle through this horrific market environment. Now, let me be clear. Neither I, nor our staff, nor the members of the Renewable Fuels Association, nor any ethanol producer I know intend to be passive observers of this market, allowing it to continue to savage our industry. Mother Nature will do what she will. But as for our industry, we don't wait for things to happen. We make things happen. The American ethanol industry will continue to command our destiny by building demand here and abroad. The RFA will keep up the work we've been doing, selling the value proposition of E15 to gasoline marketers across the country, opening new markets overseas, and preserving, protecting, and defending the renewable fuel standard here at home. battle for the barrel is a fight for higher ethanol blends, especially E15. The RFA is lucky to have the First Lady of E15, Christy Moore, to help tear down the regulatory barriers to its use. Christy coordinated the health effects testing for E15. Then she worked with EPA to develop the only model misfueling mitigation plan approved by the agency to guide gasoline marketers across the country in the proper labeling, documentation, distribution, dispensing, and sale of E15. That's critically important because marketers must have an approved misfueling mitigation plan in place before E15 can be sold to consumers. In addition to the MMP, Christy and the RFA published a retail advisory handbook, taking marketers through all of the steps for E15 commercialization, from registration with EPA to dispensing the fuel to the consumer. This handbook is an indispensable tool for marketers because of the unique regulatory treatment of E15, from addressing the residual fuel left in the hose from an E15 sale to the fire code related to higher level blends to data on underground storage tanks. But the regulatory agencies aren't our only battlefield. The major oil companies are fighting on every front, and we are fighting back, house to house and marketer to marketer. For the RFA today, that challenge falls to Robert White. He has conducted scores of webinars, attended dozens of trade shows, and created an unmatched network of supporters to promote E15. If a marketer has a question whether his underground storage tank will accommodate E15, Robert has the answer. If a marketer needs counsel on how to reconfigure his pumps to stay within EPA guidelines, Robert has the solution. Others may lay claim to firing the first shots in the battle for E15, but it will be the RFA's technical and marketplace expertise that will win the war. And win it, we will. E15 will not come easily or quickly, but it will come. Indeed, it has come. A handful of pioneering stations in Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska are today offering E15 commercially. The narrative discouraging its use, that it will damage engines and undermine automobile performance, is just poppycock manufactured by an incumbent industry that does not want to lose any more of the barrel. That narrative will fail the test of time. It will succumb to the reality that E15 being sold today is leading to none of the predicted catastrophe, and it will ultimately retreat in the face of compelling economics and consumers who will demand higher performance fuels with savings at the pump. We're also fighting the battle for the barrel around the world, from Brussels to Brazil. Last year's market distress was worsened by the ethanol trade imbalance that emerged as a result of foreign trade barriers and distortions. In 2011, the U.S. exported more than 1.2 billion gallons of ethanol, while importing less than 300 million gallons. But last year, the European Union pursued an ultimately unsuccessful anti-subsidy case against the U.S., and Brazil continued to fix its gasoline prices and lower its blend ratio for ethanol to protect its sugar industry. U.S. exports fell to just over 700 million gallons. Imports rose to almost 500 million gallons. The RFA led the fight against EU's nonsensical trade cases. We won the anti-subsidy case, and we will ultimately prevail in the anti-dumping case as well, because the Europeans are attempting to rewrite centuries of trade law by imposing countrywide anti-dumping tariffs when no anti-dumping was found by any of the companies investigated. Importantly, with their action, the Europeans are only hurting their own consumers by penalizing the lowest cost ethanol in the world today. The RFA has been second to none in raising awareness of Brazil's trade distorting practices and are committed to seeing those trade barriers eliminated. In addition to lowering its mandatory ethanol blend rate, Brazil promotes its own production with favorable tax treatment and subsidies for ethanol transportation, storage, and export. For years, Brazil spoke with righteous indignation about our offsetting tariff. The failure to address the issues we have raised represents the height of hypocrisy. Now, incredibly, while we're fighting for balanced trade policies, the US EPA actually encourages imports of Brazilian products by assigning sugarcane ethanol from that country an unjustified carbon credit relative to corn ethanol. This gives Brazilian ethanol an environmental incentive in the form of an advanced biofuel RIN that is worth more than 40 cents a gallon today. Our government should be fighting with us, not against us. EPA's carbon scoring, assigning specious indirect land use change penalties to U.S. production while ignoring the very real direct land use change and direct emissions attributable to Brazilian ethanol, is intellectually bankrupt. Without Uncle Sam's federal finger on the scale, U.S.-produced ethanol is the lowest-cost ethanol in the world. Without that RIN credit, Brazilian ethanol could not compete. With it, Brazilian ethanol is cannibalizing our market and displacing U.S. product. The inevitable consequences are catastrophic. Our plants are shuttering. Our workers are losing their jobs. And their continued evolution of our industry is stymied. This must end. Exports will continue to be, an extraordinarily important market for the future demand of our product. The RFA is committed to building new market opportunities all across the globe. That's why last year we commissioned a large-scale, in-depth analysis of the outlook for U.S. ethanol exports that will serve as the roadmap for our market development efforts. We'll need to address Europe's foolish effort to limit ethanol production from what they call food feedstocks. We'll need to confront the carbon scoring of the RED program. And ultimately, we'll need to open new markets in the Pacific Rim, India, and China, and anywhere in the world consumers are looking for clean-burning, high-performance motor fuels. Now, the most critical challenge we will face this year, indeed, perhaps the most critical challenge our industry has ever faced, will be the well-funded and highly charged political fight over the renewable fuel standard. Let me be blunt. Our adversaries are not dedicated to destroying the RFS because it has failed. Our adversaries are dedicated to destroying the RFS because it has succeeded. When the RFS was passed in 2005, our nation's dependence on foreign oil for liquid transportation fuels stood at 60%. Today, it's only 41%. That's the definition of success. Is it all because of biofuels? No. But could it have happened without biofuels, without the RFS, without ethanol? Absolutely not. Big Oil, represented by the American Petroleum Institute, has declared war on the RFS. They've been joined by Big Food, the Angry Birds, and Mad Cows, and Hungry Hogs. Together, they want to feed once more at the trough of low corn prices and government subsidies. They are putting their profits over the nation's security. This will not succeed, but it will be an epic fight. And our mantra must be, don't mess with the RFS. We will hear much about how unworkable the RFS is, how it is an inflexible mandate that increases costs at the gas pump and the grocery store. None of that is true, of course, but their message will be relentless and magnified by an advertising budget picked from the pockets of unsuspecting consumers. The fact is, the RFS is incredibly flexible. It is designed to give refiners and EPA multiple ways to meet the standards and administratively adjust the program to accommodate whatever marketplace anomalies might arise. That is why it is working so well in good years and in bad. With apologies to Bill Clinton, there is nothing wrong with the RFS that cannot be fixed with what is right with the RFS. It is an extraordinarily flexible program, and our mantra must be, don't mess with the RFS. Big Food argues that the RFS is driving up food prices. But consumers should not swallow that supersized smear. Food prices aren't rising any faster today than they were before the RFS was first enacted. In fact, food inflation rates since 2005 have been lower on average than they were from 1980 to 2004. As the EPA concluded in denying the RFS waiver request last fall, the less than 3% of the world's grain supply used by the U.S. ethanol industry does not significantly impact food prices. After all, only 14 cents of every food dollar returns to the farm. Moreover, the distillers' dried grains produced by our industry are adding value and protein to the nation's livestock feed supply. The RFA conducted analysis that we submitted to EPA during the waiver comment period. The study found that the loss of DDG feed potentially caused by waiving the RFS could actually increase feed costs, not reduce them. Their logic is flawed. Their motives are transparent. Their solution is wrong for America. And our mantra must be, don't mess with the RFS. Big Oil's argument against the RFS begins with a mythology they've created about cellulose, that the RFS requires them to blend fuels that don't exist and taxes them for obligations not met. But let's look at the facts. The fact is, because of the flexibility of the RFS, EPA has waived 98% of the cellulosic requirement since its inception. The fact is, from 2010 to 2012, EPA has required just 22 million gallons of the 850 million gallons specified by the statute. The fact is, EPA rightly maintained 2% of the statutory requirement as some measure of incentive for investors to encourage commercialization of this important sector. The fact is, the cost of the credits for those gallons has totaled just $25 million over the past 3 years. While the oil companies are crying a gusher of crocodile tears, those costs equate to just 0.0019%, 19 thousandths of a percent of the gross profits for the top five oil companies during that time. They've spent more money lobbying against the RFS than the cost of those credits every year. The top five oil companies made enough gross profit in less than 10 minutes to recover the cost of a year's worth of cellulose waiver credits. Cellulosic ethanol and other advanced biofuels are coming. The RFS is a key to getting financing for those projects. The evolution of this industry must continue, and our mantra must be, don't mess with the RFS. Big Oil has a multi-million dollar war chest, but they're short of one precious thing, a sense of shame. In an ironic twist, oil companies now point to the blend wall with almost as much urgency as we do, as if they've just discovered its potential impact. But the RFS was always intended to do two things: drive technology, as it is doing today with advanced biofuels, and drive the marketplace, as it should be doing today with E15, E85, and other higher-level ethanol blends. When it passed the 36-billion-gallon RFS in 2007, Congress knew that it could not be met with 10% ethanol blends alone. The oil companies knew that too, but they sat on their hands, refusing to make investments in blender pumps, refusing to install E85 infrastructure, and throwing up roadblock after roadblock to protect the blend wall. And now they're cynically saying that the RFS can't be met because of the obstacles that they themselves created. For the first time since the RFS was enacted, the program's 2013 requirements compel oil companies to get serious about mid-level blends. The E10 status quo won't be enough to meet the RFS this year. And that's exactly why the oil industry is pitching such a fit about the RFS and E15 today. The blend wall can be breached. It can be scaled with E15, a legal fuel oil companies can sell to consumers choosing to use it today. It can be toppled by E85 as U.S. automakers meet their promise to produce 50% of new vehicles with FFV technology. And it can be trampled with new advanced biofuels and new technologies that could rely upon ethanol's higher octane and help automakers meet the upcoming more stringent CAFE and CO2 standards. The blend wall is a barrier of the oil company's own making. We cannot reward bad behavior, and our mantra must be, don't mess with the RFS. The most creative narrative coming from big oil today, in a vain effort to undermine support for the RFS, is the notion that increased domestic oil production from non-conventional sources obviates the need for renewable fuels. New day, new circumstances, the API's Jack Girard has said. Well, where have we heard that before? In 1980, we heard there is as much oil under the North Slope of Alaska as there is in all of Saudi Arabia. Well, maybe not. Alaska field production peaked in 1988, and today is less than a quarter of its peak production. There's even concern that production may fall below the minimum levels needed to keep the Trans-Alaska pipeline flowing economically. What then? In 1999, a BP press release trumpeted the Thunder Horse discovery in the Gulf of Mexico, which was supposed to be the biggest discovery ever in the Gulf, with an estimated billion barrels of recoverable oil. Well, no. Thunder Horse never even left the stable. It never came close to the 250,000 barrels a day it was designed to produce. In fact, it lost 63% of its production in a single year. In 2007, oil analysts trumpeted the Elm Cooley field in Montana's Bakken Formation as the largest onshore discovery in the lower 48 states in a half a century. Missed it by that much. According to one analyst's recent account, after 5 years of drilling, it was pretty much tapped out, and the rigs dismantled and moved to new, more promising sites. The fact is, domestic production from conventional sources continues to fall. Increased production from non-conventional resources will make up some of the shortfall in the near term, but there will be no reduction in price. Indeed, if oil prices were to fall substantially, investments in non-conventional oil recovery technologies would be uneconomic, and there will be no long-term benefit at all. As the Elm Cooley experience demonstrated, these resources are fickle and finite and expensive. They are no long-term solution to this country's energy and economic issues. Consider this. Technically recoverable tight oil from Bakken Shale is estimated by EIA to be 3 to 4 billion barrels, and estimated by the oil industry to be as much as 20 billion barrels. Annual U.S. refiner input of crude oil is about 5.5 billion barrels. Thus, the Bakken only promises 6 months to 3.5 years worth of U.S. crude oil consumption. We can't frack our way to energy independence. The need for domestic renewable fuels remains as important as ever. And our mantra must be, mess with the RFS. As 2012 fades to a bad memory, and we look to 2013 with renewed hope and commitment, the true state of the U.S. ethanol industry is once again revealed. When the Battle of Britain began, Winston Churchill spoke 4 simple words. We will never surrender. Our industry has never wilted in the face of adversity. The men and women of American ethanol toil day in and day out to provide consumers with a high-octane, clean-burning motor fuel that saves consumers at the pump, improves the environment for future generations, and has revitalized rural America. They are as committed as ever to the growth and evolution of this industry. Together, we are steeling for the fight ahead. Together, we remain resolute. Together, we will see E15 commercialized. Together, we will open new markets here and abroad. And together, we will make sure the RFS is preserved, because we will never, ever, ever let them mess with the RFS. We will win the battle for the barrel, not only for ourselves, but for America's families, America's economy, America's rural communities, America's energy security, and America's natural environment. Thank you for being the industry that never surrenders, and for the honor of being one of you. Don't mess with the RFS. Thank you.